Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy will be with us shortly. You know, when winter comes, she's got to put those cross-country skis on her jalopy, so it takes a little bit longer to get to work when it snows. So we'll be joined by Amy shortly. So as anticipated, per our conversation in the 8 o'clock hour yesterday with Gina Swoboda, former director in the Elections Department, the Arizona Secretary of State's office, Carrie Lake has lost the governor's race in Arizona. There were some conservative talk show hosts that got a little out over their skis on Friday, not paying particularly close attention, apparently, to how these things work. And how they work, as we said last week on the show, the longer goes a protracted vote count, the more unlikely becomes the chances for the Republican candidate to win when we're talking about statewide races. We've seen this play out over and over and again. Honestly, at the statewide level, I cannot remember, other than Bush-Gore, this occurring to the benefit or the ultimate resolution in favor of the Republican candidate. And that took the state Supreme Court of Florida and the United States Supreme Court to intervene. And this is going back, you know, to 2020 and beyond, races like Norm Coleman against Al Franken. I remember the Dino Rossi governor's race in Washington State. So, as anticipated, Katie Hobbs has been declared the victor in Arizona by a 25,000 vote margin from what I last saw, with about 5% of the vote to be counted.
Yeah, it's 20,000 now. With 50, Katie Hobbs 50%, Carrie Lake 50%, and she won by 20,000. Doesn't that sound familiar, Dan? Didn't Trump lose by 20,000 votes in Arizona, too?
They're nothing if not consistent. But again, in case you thought there was anything hanky going on in Maricopa County, no. Andrea Mitchell, Mrs. Alan Greenspan, had this to say on MSNBC.
And, Mark, let's talk about what we've learned from, for instance, what's happened out in Maricopa County, what's left out there in terms of how the vote keeps, you know, coming in, despite all of what has been said by Donald Trump and other election deniers, and now beginning to be also Kelly Ward, who's falling behind about, Hobbs, but for the governor's race. Maricopa County had some of the best vote counting processes because of past problems.
Yeah.
Is she high? They've had four voting cycles in a row. Maricopa County, Pinal County, Pima County have had problems where a week after an election, then we'll know who the victor is.
If Andrea Mitchell doesn't see problems, I don't see problems. What you saw over the last week in Maricopa County is an indication of the very good vote processes they have in place. That's what you get from the D.C. press corps. So just get used to it. And by the way, if you would echo any of the issues raised by Carrie Lake, or as Andrea Mitchell calls her, Kelly Ward, then you're an election denier. So, you know, you want to wear the jacket of election denier, then you ask these uncomfortable questions about vote tabulators and toner cartridges and the like. Go ahead. But you're an election denier if you do.
They're calling her, mainstream media is calling her, and the election denier candidate, Carrie Lake, lost to Katie Hobbs. Katie Hobbs is an idiot, and I don't say that lightly. I am telling you, she hid in her basement. I called my reporter friends in Phoenix and in Tucson. Hey, Gibby, how often was she there? Was she meeting with reporters? It's like, no, she rarely held campaign rallies. She had campaign fundraisers. She'd go to rich people's liberals' houses in, you know, Creve Coeur or where Scottsdale and in Tucson. And she hid. She's got a twin sister who's smarter than her. And she's been in charge of the election. She's Secretary of State of Arizona. Shame on her. She did this, and you know, she wasn't winning, so then they waited late. Now I'm becoming a conspiracy theorist between this and what happened in Nevada. And my aunt gave her life to get Laxalt in. I mean, she has spent years working with him as a candidate. And she knew when I called her, I said, things are looking great. She said, Amy, no, they're going to steal it like they did last time.
The longer the count goes on, the more unlikely it is the Republican will win. At least that's how it exists in current form and has existed for some time. There's no question about it, which prompts all sorts of questions we'll get to. But now this is the backdrop of a big announcement today at Mar-a-Lago from President Trump, ostensibly announcing that he's going to run for president for a third time in 2024. Laura Trump, his daughter-in-law, was on with Sky News in Australia talking about what may transpire today. She had this to say.
I hope it's a very historic event. If indeed he does decide to run again, and that's the announcement we hear on Tuesday, I'll tell you, I was there for the 2015 announcement, of course, for his first run for the White House. And gosh, I didn't really realize, I think, in that moment, how historic it would be and how poignant a moment that was in my life personally, but for all of the country and really the entire world. So look, if you're lucky enough to find yourself in South Florida on Tuesday, highly recommend stopping by Mar-a-Lago. I don't think you'll ever regret it.
Mm-hmm. So Laura and Eric and Don Jr. and his betrothed Kimberly Guilfoyle are all on board. And then there's questions about whether Ivanka and Emo Phillips, her husband, are on board. I'm not sure that it matters that much to the outside world, but it apparently mattered to Trump. At least that was some of the scuttlebutt coming out of Tiffany Trump's wedding over the weekend. So we'll see who's on stage today, tonight, when President Trump makes his announcement.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also reach us always on our text line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Now, Laura also addressed the prospect of Ron DeSantis challenging President Trump. Uh-huh. And where President Trump used vinegar, Laura used some honey.
I think that Ron DeSantis is very smart. Look, he's a young guy. There will be a lot of opportunity for him in the future, and he knows this, to run for president. And so I think he's probably waiting to see what my father-in-law does. And I think he's a smart enough guy to know that it would be great to have all the support of this party, of the America First MAGA movement, whatever you want to call it, fully behind him in 2028, then possibly, you know, fracturing it in 2024. I can tell you those primaries get very messy and very raw. We've experienced that before. So wouldn't it be nicer for him, and I think he knows this, to wait until 2028?
Oh, that sounds like Hillary Clinton when Barack Obama was thinking about winning. She's like, well, he's young, he has plenty of time. Like, it's my time now, not his time.
Well, she's you know, working in service of her father-in-law, so you understand it. But that's probably a better approach than pillaring him the way that Donald Trump did. Probably better than the Ron DeSanctimonious route. Brian in St. John, Indiana.
Hey, just a quick question. What's the current House count? How many seats are still up? Where are they at, and why is it taking so long? That's all I got.
Well,
thank you, Becky.
Yeah, thanks for the call. I mean, it's like 216 to 207, I think, in called races. So they're two away from the majority. It's going to happen. You know, it's unclear if it's going to be 219, 220, 221. But Republicans will take the House, and thus you already have the potential fight over who will hold the Speaker's gavel, ratcheting up with Andy Biggs from Arizona being suggested as someone who will challenge Kevin McCarthy for the speakership. So, you know, 216 to 206, 207, 220. So there's, you know, a dozen seats out. And you know, they're spread. But I got to tell you, thinking about what happened on the House side, you can't help but look at New York, there were real gains in Long Island, in part because of Lee Zeldin's strong performance. including taking out the DCCC chair, Sean Patrick Maloney, Republicans did.
Yeah, people went to the polls to vote for him and then voted for their congressional members.
Yeah, but there's something else, too, there that's important in this larger conversation about understanding what happened at the midterms, which is it wasn't the gerrymandered map that the Democrats in New York wanted. The gerrymandered map the Democrats in New York got thrown out by a judge. And so it was a map that was more evenly distributed, consistent with sort of Supreme Court dictates when it comes to the attributes of maps, you know, contiguousness, compactness, respect for municipal boundaries. And that provided an advantage. Remember, this was the first year of new maps around the country, gerrymandered maps, and a lot of Dem states that would be, you know, cartographers like the same we have in Illinois that make it exceedingly difficult, much more difficult if the maps were less gerrymandered. That was the case in New York. And as it turns out, that may have spelled the difference between Republicans taking the House and Republicans not taking the House.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. President Trump with the big announcement tonight at Mar-a-Lago. And, of course, it's anticipated that he will announce that he is running for president again in 2024. Victor Davis Hanson, a pretty strong, consistent proponent of President Trump, you'll note, but not blind to his flaws, has a good piece in American Greatness, amgreatness.com, about this imminent announcement. What are we going to get? What path is Trump going to choose? Is he going to become a scapegoat, a tragic hero, a kingmaker? Here are the three choices, the three paths before Trump as VDH lays them out. Which do you think he will choose? Which should he choose? Will Trump rest on his considerable laurels and ride out gracefully to Mar-a-Lago? And there, as a kingmaker, elder statesman, will he work to institutionalize his MAGA agenda while raising money for any presidential candidate who embraces it? That's one. Unlikely.
I don't think that's going to happen, but all right, what's two?
Two. Or will a subdued candidate, Trump, now pivot, grow quieter, and let people vote in the primaries to decide whether they want him anymore? And whether Ron DeSantis sinks as a 2016 Scott Walker on the national stage or assumes the mythical status of Ronald Reagan? Will Trump grow quieter and let the people vote in primaries to decide whether they want him anymore? Referendum on him.
That would be nice, but all right, what's three?
Or three, will an unapologetic Trump instead now escalate his slurs, bray at the moon, play out his current angry Ajax role to the bitter end? Great mythological reference there from VDH. He is a classicist. And thus himself end up a tragic hero, appreciated for past service but deemed too toxic for present company.
Chuck, I'll go with three for 500.
Yeah, I think that's probably where the smart money is. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. VDH gives us a good review of the last 6 years of Trump. And the good, the bad, and the ugly. He sort of summarizes it, you know, this way in terms of what Trump has endured. It was not Trump but his enemies who weaponized the CIA, FBI, Justice Department. Trump, unlike Obama, did not spy on journalists. And unlike Biden, he created no ministry of truth. His supporters did not call to junk the Electoral College, pack the court, destroy the filibuster, or opportunistically add two new states. They did not radically change the voting laws through means that undermine the authority of state legislatures to end Election Day as we had known it for over three centuries. They did not turn balloting into mostly a mail-in early voting phenomena that saw the usual rejection rate of ballots plummet, even as the number of non-Election Day ballots soared. So that's what happened. That's true. But if he had stayed out of picking candidates, if he had helped all Republican candidates, including those who opposed him, as opposed to celebrating the defeat of those who opposed him, like O'Day in Colorado, if at his rallies he had advanced positive commitment to America's solutions rather than litanies of his own past hurts and grievances, and if he now pivoted and raised money for the conservative agenda rather than having trashed rivals who nonetheless have advanced his shared cause. So what they did to him and what he did to himself in response. Now, he also did a lot of good in terms of exposing the they who did those things to him that Victor Davis Hanson recounts, exposing them for who they are, laying them bare in the light of day for all to see. That's a service among the services Trump provided. But those ifs that VDH points to this cycle as the lead into 2024, if he had done those things that he didn't do, would he be in a different position now?
Would Carrie Lake have won if Trump wasn't involved? I mean, people are taking to Twitter saying that, and I thought, no. I mean, she reminded me of Trump, the way she campaigned and, you know, her attacks on the media, but she was part of the media, so she knew how it worked.
Yeah, you know, there's a actually, just on the whole, you know, Trump impact on the midterms, where people are using Trump as a scapegoat for all of the failures of the Republican Party, which isn't quite on the money. You know, a lot of people could point to him so that they don't have to take any accountability for what happened on their watch as well while they're in positions of authority, both at the federal and state level. J.D. Vance, senator-elect from Ohio, who, you know, had previously, as was talked about at rallies that Trump had for J.D. Vance, previously critical of Donald Trump in the early early stages of Trump, if you will. But as Trump said in an all too infrequent fit of good humor at the rally for Vance, gosh, if I dismissed everyone who was critical of me, then I couldn't endorse any candidate. You know, sort of being a little bit self-effacing and not being so petty as he sometimes wants to be, as we've seen with DeSantis. That was a good moment. And so both Trump and Vance got beyond what was initially said, and Trump was instrumental in Vance winning in the primary, and then Ohio's a red state. I mean, it just is. Right. And Mike DeWine winning by 25 points had a lot to do with J.D. Vance's victory. But as Vance points out in The American Conservative, something that a lot of people won't point out because they don't know, because they don't pay attention, they just repeat the whatever the pundits are prattling on, whatever they're offering in terms of this is the definitive of what happened. You know, Tim Ryan, who always cast himself as the great champion of the working man, and a lot of people got used to voting for Tim Ryan, and he had the credential of challenging Nancy Pelosi for the speakership to separate himself from the leftists who control his party, at least to attempt to, even though he's completely thrown in with them. And he's from a blue-collar area of Ohio. And he's an incumbent, and we saw the advantages incumbents have, particularly with money raising, which J.D. Vance gets to. But, you know, Tim Ryan, as Vance points out, spent the summer advancing the notion that, you know, he agreed with Trump on all sorts of things. Of course he did. Of course Tim Ryan did, because he knew that's where you needed to be to try to win the votes that had moved from, you know, blue dog Democrats to Trump voters. So, you know, just understand that in sort of the context of that particular race that played, that tells you something about the state, too. And the demographics matter. But he goes on to talk about the fundraising infrastructure that Democrats enjoy, the advantage they enjoy over Republicans. And this turns out to be, you know, pretty important. You need money to drive a message. You need money to build campaign infrastructure for field operations and get out the vote and election day work and so forth. And you go and look at some of these Senate races in particular, and the advantage that Democrats have with Act Blue, their national fundraising platform, where 21 million individual donors shovel small donations into every marquee national race. It's why John Fetterman, he writes, was able to raise $75 million for his election. Cool. Republican small-dollar fundraising efforts are paltry by comparison, and Republican fundraising efforts suffer from high consultant and list-building fees, where Republicans pay a lot to acquire small-dollar donors. This is why incumbents have such massive advantages, writes Vance. Much of the small-dollar fundraising my own campaign did went into fundraising and list-building expenses. If and when I run for re-election, almost all of it will go directly to my campaign. Democrats don't have this problem. They raise money from more donors with lower overhead. And he just goes on to, you know, explain this in more detail, giving additional examples, as we've talked about on this show. You know, Mark Kelly in Arizona, $75 million. Blake Masters, 12. You're seeing some of this criticism coming out in the direction of Mitch McConnell for spending millions of dollars trying to keep Lisa Murkowski in the Senate in Alaska while she's running against a conservative in Kelly Shabaka. Why are you spending that money for Murkowski when it's going to be a Republican seat, whoever wins, right, as opposed to trying to get a seat for Republicans, spend that money to try to get a seat for Republicans like Laxalt in Nevada or Masters in Arizona? Now, the flip side, as Mark Thiessen has argued, is that McConnell spent, you know, $250 million on candidates that won the nomination for Senate race for Senate races around the country and that were backed by Trump. Well, right, he did, but that's his job as the Senate minority leader. That's his job. And when you raise $500,000, you're supposed to spend it on candidates, whoever the nominees are, in winnable races, you know, sort of in rank order priority based on their winnability. And so why are you in Alaska spending a cent? Let Murkowski and Shabaka battle it out. What that tells you, the rank and file, is that McConnell's more interested in protecting his position as Senate minority leader than he is in winning races and trying to grow the numbers in the caucus. And that presents a problem, which is one of the reasons you're hearing calls for a challenge to Mitch McConnell and pushing off the vote for minority leader, as you heard from Ron Johnson this week over the weekend. We played yesterday. To push this off for a month like Democrats are doing, and let's have time to breathe and discuss and debate and think think a little bit, be a little bit reflective about who we really want to lead and what we're trying to do as a party. So it's just interesting, J.D. Vance rallying to the defense of Trump here, who rallied to his defense in the primary in general. I'll read a little bit more of what he says. In competitive states, every non-incumbent candidate was swamped with cash by national Democrats. This is true for Trump-aligned candidates like me, anti-Trump candidates like Joe O'Dea in Colorado, and those who straddled both camps. The House tells a similar story. Every person blaming Donald Trump or bad candidates endorsed by Trump ought to show a single national marquee race where a non-incumbent beat a well-funded opponent. The few exceptions, New York among them, don't tell an easy anti-Trump story. Yeah, that's perspective. I mean, there's a lot of variables when you're trying to understand holistically what happened and then funnel it into sort of action items in terms of what needs to be done to address some of the problems identified in advance of the 2024 election that will, well, will begin in full swing today, I think.
Are you guys ready for it?
Mike in Plano, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, guys. Yeah, I could care less for what Mark Thiessen says. Same with Josh Holmes. Those guys are backing a senator that has got a 7% approval rating. He's a single-digit midget, so we shouldn't care at all what those people have to say.
Stop focusing on the person and focus on the message. I mean, let's just focus on the message because it's not just Mark Thiessen saying it. I mean, you want me to read you part of Kurt Schlichter's screed about Trump from townhall.com? Is Kurt Schlichter going to be somebody who's, you know, in with the establishment now? I don't think so. So, I mean, this is a conversation that extends beyond sort of never Trumpers and establishment pundits and so forth. So let's just focus on the substance of the issue before us.
No, I don't think Kurt Schlichter's establishment. I think
right.
He's a Twitter smack talker. I don't really care too much for him either. But
okay.
One thing I was going to say about Trump is that if he announces he's running, I hope he keeps Ivanka and Jared away from him because they're the ones that are too polarized into the base. I mean, Jared did some good things as far as foreign policy in the Middle East. He's not a bad guy. He's very smart. But, I mean, him and Ivanka, they're both globalist liberals. They're not conservatives. We saw it out of Ivanka, you know, with all the globalist stuff she was pushing with the UN and all that. And then,
where are you on Trump, DeSantis?
I don't know yet. I don't think Trump's really taking a shot. I think he's more taking a shot at the establishment backers. I think he's just playing games. But we'll see how it plays out. But one last thing about Ivanka, she was the one that was pushing paid family leave, too. So I don't want them to anywhere near domestic policy.
Well, they might not even show up today because I don't think they want him to run, but we'll see.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Well, I'm not sure if they don't want him to run or they just don't want to go through what they went through.
Yeah.
I don't think Jared and Ivanka were particularly positive influences on Trump. But the problem is, it's difficult to find a positive influence on Trump because it's difficult to identify somebody that he listens to and takes seriously if that person disagrees with him.
Well, I thought he always listened to the advice and counsel of Mike Pence, and I felt comfortable knowing that Mike Pence was there because he's an experienced politician. And then last night I watched the entire interview with David Muir. Then there was another, you know, more in-depth story at 9 o'clock. And Trump threw him under a bus after all that he did for him. I mean, some could argue that he left him for dead downstairs at the Capitol, you know, in the loading dock.
That's
didn't
a little
help
dramatic.
Him. Well, it didn't help to pick him up and didn't do anything to stop it.
Here's the thing. You know, Mike Pence, who's got a book out now, is running for president, too. Mm-hmm. And while I think Mike Pence is a long, long, long shot for the nomination, he will be around as long as he can be, as long as he's able to raise money and hang around. And, you know, the interviews that he's giving right now, where, of course, the press corps is going right to Jan 6, and he was on with Hannity last night as well, was Pence. They're not helpful to Trump because they keep January 6th front and center, and the criticism is coming from your vice president. This is what he said to David Muir, as you were mentioning.
2:24 p.m., the president tweets, Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done. It angered me. But I turned to my daughter, who was standing nearby, and I said, it doesn't take courage to break the law. It takes courage to uphold the law. I mean, the president's words were reckless. It was clear he decided to be part of the problem.
And it's not just that criticism from Pence. It's the response it's likely to generate on the trail from Trump. And if he continues to relitigate Jan 6th, in addition to relitigating the 2020 election, then he's arguing about past things and perceived wrongs done to him. He's not offering something prospective about what he would do for the party and the country.
Right. And Mike Pence, I mean, he's following the Constitution. He couldn't return the votes to the state And he told Trump that twice. He said, we lost the election. He told him repeatedly, we lost the election. This is a process that needs to take place now. And Trump just would not accept it.
Tina, Joliet.
Hi, good morning. I just want to say I love Donald Trump. I've supported him. He was everything we needed in 2016. But these always Trumpers are just as bad as the never Trumpers. I want to win in 2024. We can't, the country can't afford another 4 years of what we're experiencing now. And Ron DeSantis, for him to come out and attack probably the strongest Republican in the country right now is so reckless to me. And there are other times where I've cringed at things he said, but this time I felt like, okay, buddy, you know, maybe it's time for you to take a backseat. Now I feel like he's being driven completely by ego.
Yep.
And everything I appreciated about his boldness and his fighting nature, if he's going to turn it on a guy who is the best governor in the country, who's done the most in his state, then that to me says, it, you know, I will walk away from that. I will 100% walk away from that.
A lot of people feel like that.
Thanks for the call, Tina. Well, I mean, this was the VDH reference to Ajax, the mythological figure who fought Odysseus for Achilles' armor, as I recall, and lost. And I won't spoil it for you.
I was going to tell that story, Dan.
But it didn't end well for Ajax.
No,
I'll just leave it there. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Simple question. This tweet from the National Education Association, you know, teachers' union, NEA, NFT, same thing. Teachers' unions. They share a brain. Educators love their students and know better than anyone what they need to learn and to thrive. Educators love their students and know better than anyone.
Oh.
What they need to learn and to thrive. Is that right? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Is that right?
No.
Why not?
Even the best teachers that you've had in the world, there's other opinions. That's why you question authority.
Educators love their students and know better than anyone what they need to learn and to thrive, the students.
Is that coming from CTU? The red shirts.
NEA. It was CTU. Yeah, it's just
CTU.
A
branch of it.
Same difference.
It's the mothership.
I know there's everybody's consumed with talk of Trump and 2024, even though we're still not through 2022's midterms, really. The House race is outstanding and so forth, leadership in both chambers. But, you know, not just the next races being school board races in the spring and municipal races, but also an understanding of what's happening in our schools that drives what's happening in society writ large, that drives, at least in part, the election returns you're seeing, particularly in the more educated, wealthier suburban enclaves of the country. So do you want to, can we walk all the way back to the starting point and take stock of from where we are starting to understand how things are finishing the way they are? Educators love their students and know better than anyone what they need to learn and to thrive. An innocuous statement? Question mark.
They just eliminate parents in that statement.
Well, as
because they want to have control over our kids, and so does the government rather than us.
As Miguel Cardona, the education secretary, explained.
He's a mimbo, too. I met him. Whew.
He explained a while ago that parents are a stakeholder
thanks,
in their children's
Miguel.
Education.
You're the best.
What he didn't say, but what is implicitly implied, is that the teachers' unions are the primary stakeholders. And if it hasn't become clear over the last couple of years, your kids are there to learn to serve the state so they can grow up prepared to serve the state. So this was, and it's interesting, too, thinking about the midterm. So you had this revolt in Virginia that put Glenn Youngkin in. You had a revolt in 2021 that almost upended Phil Murphy in New Jersey.
Well, that's right.
That took out the state Senate president in New Jersey, the truck driver who spent a few grand to take out a Senate sitting Senate president in Democrat New Jersey. And then that revolt fizzled. I mean, it may not have fizzled in particular places. We've played clips from parents standing up at school board meetings across the country, challenging their school board, fighting on behalf of their kids with respect to racialized and sexualized curricula. But we had this momentum going in 2021, particularly in the form of what happened in Virginia and in those wealthy, highly more wealthy enclaves of the more highly educated, like Fairfax and Loudoun, and it dissipated.
And you'd think soaring inflation and a rise in crime would get people to vote Republican even more so since that point, and it didn't. It fizzled.
Well, maybe part of the forward-looking agenda that wasn't presented was that fight that was happening in 2021 that was front and center in the governor's race between Youngkin and McAuliffe. And it wasn't front and center in a lot of these races, both at the federal and state levels. Maybe this is part of what we need to contemplate getting back to, and we're going to have the perfect platform to do it, school board elections in 30 states come the spring. Because there's a lot on the line, and what's on the line is growing, both in terms of trouble and opportunity. A new study of nationwide hospital databases found that between 2016 and 2019, more than 1,130 adolescents received gender-affirming chest surgeries in the United States. The study published in Journal of American Medical Association Pediatrics, JAMA Pediatrics, saw a nearly 400% increase in adolescents age 12 to 17 obtaining chest surgeries during that three-year period, 26 to 2019. And I would suggest over the subsequent 3 years, that's probably increased based on what we're seeing. Now, that's a small number of a large population, but it's growing, and so are the negative consequences. So are the adverse outcomes, to borrow a phrase from our COVID days, which are still with us. Chloe Cole is one of them. Chloe Cole is one of these kids. And now she's filed a Med-Mal suit against those medical professionals who treated her.
Wow.
And pushed her as a 12-year-old into moving in the direction of gender reassignment, including a double mastectomy. She was on Tucker Carlson the other night.
So it's a medical malpractice case. I want to hold the adults who put me in harm's way accountable because, I mean, what happened to me is horrible, but it's also, it didn't only happen to me. That's the worst part. It's happening to children all over the U.S., all over the West, and it's spreading all over the world. And
yes.
I want to be able to create a precedent for other people who have been in my situation to find justice themselves. I was 12 years old when I first expressed to them that I had distress with my gender, with being female, and that I wanted to transition to male. And they were concerned, and they wanted what was best for me, but they weren't really sure what to do with me, so they sought professional help. And from then on, I was basically affirmed in my gender identity without any questioning from any medical professionals, and they pushed transitioning as the way to treat gender dysphoria. When I was 15 years old, I had a double mastectomy. They removed both of my breasts, and I will never have them back. I will, as an adult, I never will be able to breastfeed whatever children I will have. I don't even know if, because I was put on puberty blockers and testosterone at only 13 years old, I don't know if I'll even be able to conceive a child naturally. I'm 18 years old now, and I'm, quite frankly, I am devastated with what has happened to me. It's been very hard to cope with the loss of my breasts, and it's affected other areas of my health as well. I'm really not sure about the overall picture of my reproductive health, and the treatments have made me very, very sickly, actually.
Educators love their students and know better than anyone what they need to learn and to thrive, because the affirming that's going on is not just from the medical community, and there needs to be a reckoning there as well. There has been, to some extent, when it's been exposed. Vanderbilt shut down their ghoulish clinic after it was exposed by Matt Walsh. Tavistock across the pond in merry old England shut down, too, after the assessments were a lot of negative outcomes. The gender reassignment zeitgeist was not helping these young people. Surprise, surprise. And in the schools, of course, they're doing the same thing, both with the curriculum from the primary grades to, as we heard from teachers in California at a conference, game planning how to work around parents who won't get on board with their child assuming a different identity, demanding to be called a different name, addressed with different pronouns, and ultimately, in many cases, going down this path to puberty blockers and mutilation.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
I know.
I feel so bad for that girl, Chloe.
Well, there's so many cases. We've heard from many of them, the people, the detransitioners who are courageous enough to come forward and are broken because of the choices they made as people that are not of the age to make those choices according to the law. But there's no adults pumping the brakes. Parents, medical professionals, teachers, where are they? Oh, by the way, conversely, police in Lloyd, New York, have arrested a woman accused of letting her 10-year-old get an arm tattoo, as well as the tattoo artist who inked the child. The 33-year-old mom was arrested October 4th. She was charged with one count of endangering the welfare of a child, a Class A misdemeanor. So the 10-year-old got an arm tattoo. And mom says, I didn't think it was going to be a permanent tattoo. I thought it was one of those stick-ons. But regardless, even if she green-lighted it, first of all, who needs parental consent for a tattoo? You don't need parental consent for an abortion. In California, you don't need parental consent to mutilate yourself as a 10-year-old. But you have to get mom's permission. I mean, New York's the same, and they will be, I'm sure, with the mutilation piece. But you have to get mom's permission for a tattoo, for an arm tattoo? And then you're actually going to enforce it? You're going to arrest mom and charge her with a Class A misdemeanor?
Well, and
so in New York, 18 years old before you're allowed to make the decision to get a tattoo. But an abortion? Trans surgery? No problem.
And the 10-year-old, he walked into the nurse's office to get, Vaseline for the tattoo, and she was appalled, and she called the police on the mom.
Right. The arm tattoo is appalling because, again, the minor doesn't have the mens rea to make that decision. But invasive surgeries, not a problem. Whatever the 10-year-old says, do it.
But, and by the way, the boy's mother was arrested.
How upside down is this?
It's very upside down.
So is this a battleground on which we want to fight? Starting at the school board level.
It's just,
where you can't claim it's too big to get your arms around. It's where you live. It's your school system. They're your fellow parents with kids in the same schools.
And again, the American Academy of Pediatrics fully endorses gender transitions for minors.
Matt, Mount Greenwood.
They're based in Itasca.
These people have all been evil for years. I'm just there's so many variables here, and Danny hit it on the head. It starts with the parents. My kids don't go out of the house without understanding respect for themselves and respect for others. And I feel bad for the people who want to try to transition my children or get into their heads. To raise them, God willing, with morals and decency and respect for themselves and others. And I think the root of it is at the parents' level. These people have been indoctrinated. The parents have been indoctrinated for, you know, two generations now. It's only coming to roost right now. It's sickening. And sue the doctors, go ahead. But what about the government who's pushing the regulations that allow the insurance companies to pay for this? Right? You could go right on down the line. But at the end of the day, it's the parents, in my opinion.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Matt. Well, I mean, you heard from Chloe Cole when she said, my parents didn't know what to do, so they sought the advice of medical professionals.
Right.
You know, in a different era, I'm not sure that would be the same. Meaning my parents didn't know what to do. It would have been so shocking, so unfathomable to allow your daughter to go down this path that ultimately led to a double mastectomy at 15, that it wouldn't have been considered. I would say I'm not substituting a quote-unquote expert's judgment for my judgment with something that you don't need a medical degree to appreciate is life-altering. Maybe I want second and third and fourth opinions before I allow my minor daughter to go down this path. But because it is so celebrated, I mean, I will say one of my favorite phrases, what a society extols, it begets. And it extols this, all of the institutions. And so it begets more of it. And otherwise, commonsensical people substitute the judgment of quote unquote experts for their own good sense. So I don't know what to do. I better just defer to the professionals, which is exactly what the NEA is saying with that tweet. No one knows better than us. Don't even think about substituting your judgment about how your children should be educated for ours. We know. You don't. That's what they're saying. Randy and Sandwich.
Dan, Amy, good morning. I think America's been on this collision course for quite some time. And we can look all the way back to Hillary when she said, it takes a village to raise your kids. And that sort of started us down this hill where the snowball is gaining more momentum, where you have teachers now that want kids to mask up and get the vaccine and just fall in line and listen to whatever they say, and where we're allowing kitty litter boxes in the bathroom because one kid decides he's going to be a cat that day. And when you pull back the camera and you look at this from a wider angle, there's some questions that really need to be answered on how we're going to fight this going forward. And one of the most important ones that I believe needs to be answered is this. If you send Ron DeSantis to the White House and they start attacking him just like they did Trump, does he have the money to go through these court cases? Does he have the thick skin to not cave because he's going to constantly be picked away during this fight? Where Trump, we know, does have the money, and Trump does have the thick skin, and he will continue to battle on. And I don't think we need to unband him now. Thank you. Have a good day.
All right, Randy. Thanks for the call. Joe Palatine.
Hi, good morning. I would like to thank both of you very, very much and the others on this station that kind of keep all of us grounded. You think you're going crazy and we're losing this. I don't call it United States of America. It's now States of America. And I just want to thank you because after listening to you folks every day, it kind of makes you feel, hey, you're not going crazy here. You just brought up a point. It's okay to kill a baby, but you can't get a tattoo. And you go, what's going on with the morals in this country? So thank you very much, both of you, for getting up early. And all you did in this last election, I really appreciate it from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate the call. Thank you. At the local level here, school board race is coming up.
Yep.
If you disagree with the NEA, if you are opposed to drag queens, scantily clad men pretending to be women prancing around in your school, if you're opposed to explicit pornographic material as part of your kids' K through 12 curriculum, then just so you know, hey, suburbanites, you paying attention? Little pipsqueak fascists like identitarian Daily Herald reporter Russell Lissau, they're on the lookout for you. They're on the lookout to smear you.
Oh, bring it. Let's go.
Russell Lissau, this pipsqueak fascist at the Daily Herald. If you live in Des Plaines, Wheeling, Barrington, or Mundelein areas and learn of candidates for school, library, municipal boards in 2023 who are political extremists, particularly anyone who wants to restrict sex ed, restrict LGBTQ rights, or ban books, let me know. Uh-huh. And then if you, we already are seeing such candidates surface, you can email me at blah, 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 blah. And, you know, if you live in other school districts, tell me, or other regions, tell me, and I'll put other people on it. Yeah, they're going to, if you stand up for sanity, for
your kids, children,
kids' physical and mental well-being,
yeah,
then you're going to be targeted by these pipsqueak fascists with bylines at rags like the Daily Herald.
Oh,
so
it's going to be good. Because Barrington, they're already getting a group together, you know, to run.
Right.
They're very active in that. We're going to have them on.
So understand where the battle lines are drawn.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get calls from these pipsqueak fascists at these rags, these Pravda-like rags in Chicagoland, you need to pay attention. They are the comm shop for other pipsqueak fascists in public office and their financiers. Focus on the substance of these issues and bring the fight. Bring the fight. Simple questions. Is that right? You're just a stakeholder in your kid's education, not the primary stakeholder? And of course, that necessarily includes the teachers and includes the administrators and coaches and so forth. Of course it does. It's not either or. It's hierarchy. Hierarchy. That's the issue. And they want to put themselves at the top of the pyramid with respect to your children and displace you at the top. So you better establish who the king of the hill is here. Unless you want this to continue to go off the rails, as we're documenting with examples from all over the country. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So we still have this runoff election in Georgia for the Senate seat currently held by Ralph Warnock. And, of course, Herschel Walker challenging him. Control of the Senate is no longer in doubt with the losses in Nevada and Arizona. But to maintain the 50-50 split and require a VP tie-breaking vote still provides more opportunity than 51-49.
Yep.
Particularly with some Republicans that tend to stray on any range of issues in the caucus, and also the opportunity on occasion to bring some Democrats, maybe a couple of them, Manchin and Sinema, over to the Republican side on an issue or two, at least temporarily.
Yeah. Trying to be positive today.
So what happens in Georgia come the first week of December in this runoff? now that sort of the heat has been tamped down on it, at least nationally. Well, to help us explore that, we're pleased to be joined by Janelle King. She's the co-founder of Speak Georgia, a panelist on Fox 5 Atlanta's Georgia Gang, and former deputy state director of the Georgia Republican Party. Janelle, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm happy to be back. Thank you for having me.
So it was just a few thousand votes that separated Warnock from Walker in the general. Do you expect the same in the runoff, maybe a lower overall turnout, but it's going to come down to a few thousand votes again?
You know what? I think it's going to come down to what's motivating each side. We definitely have some new factors in play now, knowing that this race wouldn't determine who controls the Senate. It would just put us back at 50%. So I do think it's going to come down to a few votes. I'm not sure who is going to ultimately, take it, but I do think it's going to come down to that. But what we're looking at on the Republican side is the importance of this is a long-term game. This race is going to determine what happens in 2024. And one of the things that my husband mentioned to me is that if we pick up this seat and we are in a 50-50 position, then that puts us in a better spot when it's time to elect our president, because now our vice president, if we win in 2024, the Republican mm-hmm. vice president will become the deciding vote, right? Yep. Rather than, the Democrat. And it's easier to flip one extra seat than having to flip two to gain majority.
So, Janelle, I just got back from Atlanta. My son goes to Georgia Tech, and I'm a bit of a local news nerd. So whenever I go in, I just watch news. And, your campaign continues until December 7th. The ads were crazy. But watching local news in the morning, Brian Kemp is really stepping up, I think, to help Herschel Walker, and that's what's needed.
Yeah, it was surprising to me to hear that the Herschel Walker campaign did not reach out to the governor during the general. Mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty odd, but I do see that Governor Kemp is assisting by providing ground support. And one of the things that he is known for, which I don't understand why other candidates have not duplicated, is having such a strong ground support. So I definitely think that that's the best way he can assist right now, because I heard that Warnock is throwing, I think, $7 million into his ground game. So it's definitely time for us to combat that. Not to mention, we do have Greater Georgia, which is founded by former Senator Kelly Loeffler. So I do think that it's going to help to have a strong, strong ground game on top of what she's already producing and helping and supporting us with.
Yeah, I'm not sure in the general election. I'm not sure it was the lack of Walker reaching out to Kemp. I think it was the lack of Kemp being interested in aiding Walker because he was running ahead of Walker and he didn't want to risk it. Because I know a lot of conservative donors in Georgia, and I think they were a little disappointed at the distance that Kemp put between himself and Herschel Walker. So he has some, in my view, from what I understand, he has some amends to make here in this runoff, and I'm glad to hear that he's making them.
Well, so that's interesting, because when you look at what happened with Warnock, right? So Stacey Abrams kind of brought Warnock down a little bit, because there's a lot of Democrats who were supporting Stacey Abrams, supporting Warnock. But then when Stacey Abrams came onto the scene, they kind of highlighted certain things, and it hurt him as well. Governor Kemp is interesting. Even when I supported him in 2018, when we wound up with a state party, he ran against Stacey Abrams the first time. Even going back to Secretary of State, Governor Kemp has always kind of been focused on everyone running their individual race. If you think about it, Abrams and Warnock didn't show up together a lot either. True. So it was, so I do think that they were all looking at the polling numbers and saying, hey, it's probably better that I stay over here and run my own race so that I can help kind of pull votes in your direction, which is what I think Governor Kemp did. And not to mention, during that last debate, Stacey Abrams kept saying multiple times to Governor Kemp, how is it that you support our heartbeat bill, but you're not condemning Herschel Walker? So she kept trying to tie them together because she knew that would cause the evangelicals who are upset with some of the information that came out against Walker, they would then be able to tie that to Governor Kemp, and it would hurt him as well. So I do think the overall strategy worked on both sides, but I am excited to hear that he's going to be providing ground support in this December 6th.
Well, I mean, he went on the air on, you know, local radio or TV station saying, you know, we should, you know, anyone who supported me should support Herschel Walker. But is he going to have a campaign rally with him and be seen in public with him? Is he going to do more than just provide ground support?
I don't know. And again, I don't know if that would be helpful, too, because we still, you know, it's interesting. My husband and I are getting ready to go speak in Troup County this afternoon. And it's another rural part of Georgia. And one of the things we're going to talk to them about is this litmus test that I feel like is kind of permeating throughout our party. And so you have people who held their nose and voted for Governor Kemp because they preferred Senator Perdue or any other Trump-picked candidate. And then you have people who held their nose and voted for Herschel, you know? So the party is a little split. So I don't really know if it's going to benefit Herschel's team to have Governor Kemp on the stage because of how some people are feeling. But I do think that this is something that we got to have as a family conversation with the party, is that we can't turn into the Democrats and start creating these litmus tests. It's like, oh, you're not progressive enough, like on their side. Over here, it's like you're not Republican enough because, you know, you don't support President Trump or you don't support certain policies or, you know, I mean, I just think we got to be careful with that because we're supposed to be expanding the tent, not shrinking it. And you're starting to shrink it when you start cutting people out.
Well, and also it needs to be all hands on deck, as you were mentioning at the outset, in terms of the fundraising. It's notable, and this is an issue that is getting a little bit more play now that we're a little bit farther removed from November 8th. Going back and looking at some of the numbers, the outspending the Democrats were able to do against Republicans in so many of these challenger Senate races. I mean, Warnock has raised $125 million to, which is incredible in Georgia, to Walker's like $35 or $38 million. So he's getting outspent, or he did get outspent about 4-1 to only come in a few thousand votes down. And we've seen this play out with Fetterman in Pennsylvania and Kelly in Arizona and elsewhere. And, you know, this is where some pressure probably needs to be put on McConnell and the fundraising infrastructure in the Republican Party to be all hands on deck for Walker in this last 3 weeks, too.
Yeah, I think that the fundraising aspect has always been an aspect for a very long time. I would like to see the party come up with a strategy where we're utilizing our money better, because typically Democrats, they burn up a lot of money, but a lot of their money goes towards consultants. A lot of their money goes towards media. So, but you, and then, you know, when it comes to the ground game, they've worked with a lot of different organizations to assist and kind of put that together. So I think with the Republican Party, we got to kind of do the same thing. I mean, when you have less money, that means you have to increase effort, right? So that means that you have to be on the ground a lot more if you're not in the airways a whole lot. So I think having that conversation will be beneficial to our side, because we don't have we have lost the culture war. So we don't have the entertainers. We don't have the athletes. We don't have these huge support groups that come from the culture to help fund money towards us like the Democrats have. So we have to find a way to make sure that we're utilizing the money we do have in the best way possible. I do think that's something we can talk about.
What about the Trump factor? I mean, obviously, Trump lost Georgia in 2020. He's set to make an announcement tonight in Mar-a-Lago, probably, that he's running for president again. Does he help or hurt if he gets involved to support Walker in the last 3 weeks before the December 7th runoff? And then more globally, what do you think about Trump as the nominee in 2024 as it pertains to Georgia?
So the Trump factor is very interesting. It's quite interesting in that I think that when it all comes down, I do think that President Trump plays a interesting role. I personally think that he would be a better kingmaker behind the scenes than being the king right now, because he is extremely polarizing. I do think that whenever there's a referendum against President Trump, it does weigh down and hurt some of the candidates that he supports. And we can't deny that. If you think about our election, let's just look at what happened with Walker. He and Burt Jones were the only two Trump-endorsed candidates. And Burt Jones won his lieutenant governor seat, but he won it by a small margin. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that no one was watching the race. When it comes to Walker, he and Warnock received less than 2 million votes. They were the only two candidates on the ballot that didn't hit the 2 million threshold. Not only that, but 200,000 people who supported Governor Kemp on the Republican side, or I'll just say in general, did not support Walker. And then 100,000 people who supported our labor commissioner did not support Walker. So what we've learned about this is that you cannot force Republicans to choose between their values and their principles and whether or not they want to be a team player. Putting us against the wall, even in 2021, there are people who felt deeply about the 2020 elections, and that's why they didn't show up in 2021 and vote, because they just did not trust the system. And that is putting them, again, up against the wall to say whether you should forgo your personal values and then just be a team player. You can't do that with the Republican Party, because like 99.9% of us are Republicans because of the values. We don't follow people as much. So I do think that President Trump poses that same challenge, right? It's like, am I going to forego certain things that I support morally in order to support some of the things that he's saying? And because I understand that he's great when it comes to policy. So I don't know if it will be a benefit. I'm happy that we do have a possible option in DeSantis, but I just don't see how Trump will be able to overcome some of the attachment to the narrative that's been placed on him.
She is Janelle King, co-founder of Speak Georgia, panelist on Fox 5, Atlanta's Georgia Gang, former deputy state director for the Georgia Republican Party as well. Janelle King, thanks for joining us again, and good luck on the campaign trail.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. What do you need to hear from Trump tonight if he announces he's running for president again in order to contemplate supporting him to be the nominee in 2024? What, if anything, do you need to hear in order to consider supporting him?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can also text us. We're monitoring the text line at 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. I don't know. What do you need to hear from him?
Well, I'll get to that in a second. But first,
ultimate tease. Okay.
Previewing tonight was Laura Trump, his daughter-in-law, married to one son, Eric. And she's going to be with her father-in-law, as is her husband, Eric, tonight, as we understand it. She had this to say in previewing this evening.
I hope it's a very historic event. If indeed he does decide to run again, and that's the announcement we hear on Tuesday, I'll tell you, I was there for the 2015 announcement, of course, for his first run for the White House. And gosh, I didn't really realize, I think, in that moment how historic it would be and how poignant a moment that was in my life personally, but for all of the country and really the entire world. So look, if you're lucky enough to find yourself in South Florida on Tuesday, highly recommend stopping by Mar-a-Lago. I don't think you'll ever regret it.
Really? It's open invitation at Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah,
I doubt
Dan,
it.
Let's go. No, yeah. Like, you're not that far. Jump in your car. Come on, do it for the show.
Laura also addressed the prospect of a serious challenge to President Trump winning the nomination again. That would be one Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Here's what she said.
I think that Ron DeSantis is very smart. Look, he's a young guy. There will be a lot of opportunity for him in the future, and he knows this, to run for president. And so I think he's probably waiting to see what my father-in-law does. And I think he's a smart enough guy to know that it would be great to have all the support of this party, of the America First MAGA movement, whatever you want to call it, fully behind him in 2028, then possibly, you know, fracturing it in 2024. I can tell you those primaries get very messy and very raw. We've experienced that before. So wouldn't it be nicer for him, and I think he knows this, to wait until 2028?
It's nice for Laura to be so considerate of Ron DeSantis' interests.
Thanks, Laura. Again, that reminded me of Hillary Clinton, like, when she said Barack Obama's young, he has plenty of time to, you know, become president. But when the window opens, you got to go. You've got to take the opportunity. And I think now's the opportunity for DeSantis. And you've said it many times. I mean, this is his last term as governor, and we need him right now.
It's sort of the Moonlight Graham thing. Uh-huh. You know, I thought there would be plenty more at-bats, but it turned out that was the only at-bat. And I think that's sort of the same thing in politics. You have to hit it when you're at the height of your opportunity and popularity. And it's tough to see DeSantis in a stronger position in contemplating a national run, even against a former president, than he is now. And frankly, you know, I'm where many Republicans aren't. I'm a proponent of primaries because I like competition.
Right.
It's odd that so many Republicans who are otherwise proponents of competitive markets don't want a competitive market when it comes to candidates for office. I do. So I think it's good to have DeSantis in the race, and I think it's good for people to see the two and other candidates who may choose to run side by side or side by side by side by side. And then you get to choose from a menu of options, and there's nothing wrong with that. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. As far as the speech tonight,
yeah,
given where Trump is and the missteps that I believe he made in the midterms and certainly in the closing days and subsequent days after the midterms, in attacking DeSantis, in celebrating the losses of Republican Party nominees like Joe O'Day in Colorado.
Doesn't help the party.
It's a bad look.
Yeah.
But in terms of tonight, you know, Greg and Schomburg had texted, does Trump need to do something akin to a Nixon checkers speech? And I think that's a pretty good comparison, pretty good reference. So you remember Nixon's checkers speech in 1952. He is running as VP with Eisenhower, and there's controversy surrounding a PAC that was set up supporting the candidacy that was reimbursing him for expenses and allegations of corruption. So this is like 6 weeks before the general in 1952. So Nixon leaves the campaign trail. He goes to L.A. to do a 30-minute nationally televised speech addressing the issues, talking about his addressing the allegations, talking about his humble beginnings, attacking his opponents. And then, you know, he invokes Checkers, the dog. You know, this is the only real campaign expense he cares about is caring for, you know, Checkers, his dog. And of course, this completely flips the story. It's received very well nationally, and Eisenhower and Nixon go on to romp in 52. And does he need some sort of mea culpa, which is very difficult for him? Oh. Probably won't come in the form of I was wrong or I apologize for this, but it could be presented in a way of being reflective, talking about the ability to do better, maybe without admitting wrongdoing. It's almost like a out-of-court settlement, right?
Right.
Nobody admits any wrongdoing, but, you know, the payment.
There's somebody was wronged. Yes.
Well, somebody pays and somebody receives.
Right.
So I think there's a rhetorical payment that Trump needs to provide to the Republican Party electorate, to a lot of them that are dispirited from the results of the midterms, that are annoyed by some of his more recent antics, and that are, buyers of the story that Trump was a drag on Republican Party's chances in the midterms, both through candidate selection in the primaries and behavior in the general.
Our text line is blowing up. Dan and Amy, he's too much of a distraction. We need new blood. We need to hear that DeSantis is supporting Trump 2024. Then I would vote for him if DeSantis said yes. Dan and Amy, he needs to sound more civil and be able to rattle off facts. Information should roll off his tongue. He should be hyper prepared.
Okay.
Some.
Brian in Wheatfield, Indiana.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I just want to say I'm totally on board with Trump's agenda, but I'm so scared he's just going to make it all about him. It's going to be all about the 2020 election, and then, you know, all that focus is going to be on him. Much as I'd love to see, like, Trump for 4 years and DeSantis for eight, that brings me, like, you know, 12 years, that brings me close to retirement. Things would look pretty good for me on a selfish standpoint, but I'm just so scared this dude's going to make it all about him, and that's going to be all it is. And then we're not going to get anywhere any further than we are right now, so that's my worry.
Thanks for the call,
Brian. All I know is I can't take another 4 years of this. Well, 6 more years of living like this. I mean, you thought with the soaring inflation and high crime that people would vote for Republicans more in the midterm, and it didn't happen. So I don't know if Trump's the answer. But, obviously if he wins the primary, we'd support him. But I just think that his time has come and gone. I'm appreciative of everything that he's done. Trust me, with appointing Supreme Court justices and making a better business atmosphere, especially for small businesses. But I just don't know if I could stomach another 4 years because of his communication style. I mean, if he gets up there tonight and says, he's not on Twitter, but he's going to be reinstated to Twitter. If he gets up there and says, I'll be a different man. I'm here for you. I want your life to be better, not my life to be better, to be vindictive against people who've prosecuted me. Then maybe I'd consider it, but I don't know. It's going to be a big call there.
What if he brings out, instead of a Cocker Spaniel, what if he brings out a tabby cat named Checkers, and he says, all I care about is winning this for my tabby cat Checkers, that Don Jr. named.
And then he goes, meow, meow.
Yeah. Would that change
her? Meow, meow. Mm-hmm. No. It's going to take a lot more than that.
Alex Hinsdale.
Hey, good morning, guys. I'll make it brief, but Amy, I think that, and I don't mean this to be condescending, they're lulling you into what they want to happen. Just go with anybody else but Trump. We're looking out for the Republican Party. When the Democrats say that, they're telling you exactly who they're most afraid of. Trump has figured out the parlor game they played. All he has to say is that from this day forward, it's going to be a new start, new beginning with me. But I know who the enemy is. We know who it is. It's not a shock. When he said that if we don't get the rules fixed in the elections, we wouldn't win, he was correct. So I think he can be abrasive. This is a contact sport. If we don't get ready, there's 4 or 5 states that they know. It's like me playing Monopoly with my little brother, and he's the banker. I'm going to lose every time. We have got to play hand-to-hand combat with them.
Thanks for the call, Alex. Although I think there's a good reason to believe that Ron DeSantis is not averse to being a rhetorical pugilist either, Trump is more engaging because stylistically,
right.
but DeSantis is definitely more polished.
Oh, right.
And when somebody who texted about having facts roll off the tongue and being, in command of the issue.
That is
Ron DeSantis, as we've seen him as governor of Florida.
And DeSantis is not going to tweet his way out of office.
So, Trump, I mean, I think there, this new start, the pivot, one is how he addresses any potential opponents, including DeSantis. That's going to be very interesting. Two is whether this is a retrospective Trump at a campaign rally or a prospective Trump running for president in 2024. That will be interesting and impactful. And can he, sort of keep it room temperature, like when Trump has been at his best, in my view, as a presidential candidate or as a president, where he sticks mainly to sort of the four corners of prepared remarks and is very substantive. He can make the parenthetical remarks and as he provides his commentary, but where, like State of the Union addresses, where he surprised because he kept it relatively buttoned down. I think as much as some people like the unpredictability, I think right now he needs to convey the ability to provide stability
Right.
So we'll see if he chooses to do any of the above. But now I think that's what he needs to do if he's going to garner consideration, including from a lot of people. And you're hearing from the people calling the show or texting the show. I voted for Trump in 16 and 20. I supported Trump. I still appreciate what Trump did. But if you want people to stop saying but after that, those predicate, you know, the predicate of I did all these things and I appreciate all these things. If you want people to stop there and stop saying but, then I think he's got to do some of the things I just suggested.
And his former, you know, partner, Mike Pence, who has a book out today, he was asked the question, do you want President Trump to run again?
Do you believe that Donald Trump should ever be president again?
David, I think that's up to the American people. But I think we'll have better choices in the future.
And one of the choices will probably be Mike Pence. But
well,
I don't.
Yeah, I mean that's sort of a canned question. I mean, what's he supposed to say? He's standing up a presidential campaign. Of course, he thinks there's better choices, including himself. Clay and Wheeling.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I like DeSantis. I like Trump. I think it'd be detrimental to the GOP if they debated each other and just tore each other down. I think the far left in this country is a lot more afraid of Trump than they are DeSantis, and I because of his unpredictability. But yes, Dan, I do agree with you. I think we do need to see some sustainability out of the guy. You know, that whole thing is I voted for Trump, but, you know, I think we need a 2016 Trump, you know, right in the beginning, raw, hard-hitting, straight to the fact, you know, it will be total chaos if he cannot stop talking about the January 6th thing, which he has a habit of doing, of bringing up, you know, old stuff out of the past. But, you know, I do, I'd say, I'd open with, you know what, I'm not the big guy. I'm not taking 10% cut. My kids don't paint, and they're not going for, their artwork is not going for $500,000. And none of my kids have had dental surgery to repair their cracked teeth. And there's no pictures flying around of any of my kids in their underwear with wearing a red scarf.
Okay. All right.
Can you imagine? I mean, they'd be all the mainstream media would be all over if that was one of the Trump kids who acted like that.
Greg in Schaumburg, since he gave us the Checkers speech reference. Yeah.
Hey, Dan and Amy. Okay, here's what he should say. He should start with a different tone, not the ballistic Trump tone. And he should start with young people because that's who he loses. And he should start with basically saying, I want to set a new tone and a new plank to young people because I'm an old person. I'm not going to be around much longer, and neither is my generation, but you are going to be the people that inherit everything that is going on right now. And therefore, I'm going to put some things in front of you right now that you ought to talk about among your peers as it affects you. Number one, the monetary source of the world. Why is China, why is Russia buying up all of this gold? They want to replace the dollar as the world currency. That has incredible implications for you. Secondly, elections. Why is it that we have problems with elections? We need to reform that. The longer, to quote my good friend Dan Proft, the longer the elections go on, the more the Republicans tend to lose. Russia and China, look at what they're doing. They invaded the Ukraine. They're ready to invade Taiwan. That has implications for you. And last but not least, the debt. Look at the tremendous amount of trillions of dollars that has been added in the Biden administration. Talk it over among your friends. It's going to be your life, but I'm standing for you in America first.
All right. Thanks for the call, Greg.
Well, we got a lot of remarks. Text messages. Ooh, well, here's the one. What if DeSantis joins him on stage tonight, Dan and Amy? Would that change a lot of people's tunes?
Well, obviously. Yeah,
that would be with Checkers, you know, the cat. Yeah.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do a lot of fame. I mean, I started with Checkers, I guess. So yeah, DeSantis. Sure, DeSantis, Pence. We get the gang all back together.
Everything will be fine.
Everybody is aligned. He comes out with the entire ticket or cabinet set. I don't think that's going to happen.
No, I don't either.
That's fun. It's fun to think about. And now for my special guest, Greg in Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. I think Pence is about done with his latest comments. You know, Trump can go against DeSantis for the president, and then down the line, basically get out of the race, and then DeSantis makes him the vice presidential candidate, and he's got a number of things that he's got to do. One, close the border. Two, bring industry back to this country, manufacturing drugs, you name it. And one of the biggest jobs of his would be to basically not drain the swamp, obliterate the swamp, get rid of a minimum of 500,000 federal workers. Department of Education, gone. Many departments gone.
Are you saying DeSantis and Trump run, DeSantis wins, and then he makes Trump his VP?
No, I say Trump bows out down the road and then becomes the VP candidate. But that'll never happen because the guy's ego is too big. But that is the winning ticket right there, man.
All right. No doubt about it. All right. Thanks, Greg. I love fantasy politics. Tom in Blue Island.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I'd want to walk Amy back a little bit on trying to get Trump to be somehow apologetic for his behavior, with the exception of, I hope he doesn't go after DeSantis. The winning ticket is without a doubt Trump and DeSantis, and I think they both, more Trump, Dan, than DeSantis. They need to realize that. Those two barnstorming the United States for 2 years, they're both MAGA candidates. Dan, I asked you this a while back. I still don't see, other than demeanor, policy-wise, anything between the two. So I don't even see, like, what a debate would look between them. I just hope Trump doesn't attack DeSantis, and hopefully they can figure out a way to get together, because when do election anomalies stop being anomalies and fact, Dan? So
I don't want him to attack anybody but Biden and his policies. I don't want to hear about any of that catty stuff. Just stick to the point.
Frank, Arlington Heights.
The girls love Chuckers, and we're not giving back the dog. But
pretty
here's
good.
Something.
Pretty good,
Nick. It's your last caller. You know, so it won't be an issue for debate with them. Is, you know, what are the different personnel choices you're going to make, Mr. Trump? Okay, I mean, who did you have in there? Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State? You let Jeffrey Sessions decide what he wanted to be when he would have been a better Department of Homeland Security. Gary Cohen, Anthony Scaramucci. I mean, or just a whole bunch of other ones. Remember that other, forget the girl, the woman he had as Secretary of Homeland Security later. Some of the defense secretaries. Horrible yeah. personnel decisions. And how are you going to increase the base? One of the reasons that I was attracted to Trump, he was a non-traditional Republican, yet he was combative, and he went after the old guard in the Republican Party. And he went after the Democrats well, too. But then I thought, once he gets in, he's going to learn how to divide and conquer. He'll learn how to work with the Democrats where he can. You can't just, you know, be the big human bowling ball and roll over everybody all the time. Sometimes you have to have a little bit of finesse in your game. So what are you going to do differently in terms of your tactics if you are president a second term? Or is this going to be more of the same nonsense where the country's consistently divided? You have to grow the Republican Party. They haven't really won a majority election since 88. I think Bush did it a little bit in 2004. But what are you going to do to grow the party? What are you going to do to convince people that we have better policies rather than just yelling at everybody all the time? That's all your right. point of debate between DeSantis and Trump. Have a
all
great
right.
day.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Also, well-considered remarks from Frank as well as Greg from Schaumburg. We appreciate all the calls.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The answer.
Insert Democrat socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House floor for 30 plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out.
Said, top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Out. That theme music means it's time for our weekly conversation with Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints.org, all things Illinois policy and politics related. But first, a Chicago man attacked, repeatedly sexually assaulted, and threatened to kill a woman who was temporarily living with him until the nearly naked victim managed to escape and flag down a Chicago police officer.
Let me guess, was he on electronic monitoring?
On bail for a pending aggravated DUI that he repeatedly failed to show up in court for. He's the 47th person accused of killing or shooting or attempting to kill or shoot someone in Chicago while awaiting trial for a felony this year. The alleged crimes involve at least 85 victims, 21 of whom died. Now, that was Friday. A Chicago man shot and killed his girlfriend while on electronic monitoring, then ran out of the house so he could get to court on time for a hearing. The woman's 3-year-old daughter told police she saw this person kill her mom.
Poor baby.
He is the 48th person accused of killing or shooting or attempting to kill or shoot someone in Chicago while awaiting trial for a felony this year. The alleged crimes involve at least, count with me, 86 victims, 22 of whom died.
Please tell me there's no more.
Well, that's as of yesterday. So, it's early on Tuesday, so we still have time.
It's snowing, so we have a better chance.
Do we? The only difference between what we have now and what's coming is we won't have to worry about the pesky electronic monitoring or bail for individuals like the two I just mentioned. That's your Pritzker Purge law. And it's coming January 1. I know there's the court case in Kankakee Circuit Court, and I know that's going to be decided next month. And I know there's a good chance the Kankakee County judge is going to declare it unconstitutional. In fact, that's what I think is going to happen. But then it will be appealed up to the Supreme Court, which has a 5-2 Democrat advantage, two of whom newly elected justices financed by Governor Pritzker in their campaigns this past cycle. And what's the posture of the supermajority Democrat socialist leadership in the House, Welch and Harmon in the House and the Senate, respectively? Have they indicated that they see any problem with the Pritzker Purge law, that they want to scrap it and start over? No, they have not. For more on this, now Ted Dabrowski joins us. Ted, thanks for being with us again.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
So we're in veto session this week. How exciting. I know there was pronouncements from Pritzker, clean up some language. Oh, we'll take a look at it. Oh, this and that. As he was getting hammered on the issue, he started to modify his position and respond, to the claims, the legitimate claims, the actual truthful claims that have been advanced by prosecutors around the state. But, I mean, is there any prospect other than through the courts that you're going to see a change in this law? And even if it were declared unconstitutional, then what should we expect the General Assembly will do?
Yeah, so you can predict no changes, hardly any changes. So the veto session was meant to improve some of this Safety Act. But even though the pressure Pritzker felt, and certainly your ads were a big part of that, put pressure on him. He had to respond. He could not ignore it. And so he responded. But now that you've seen the results of the elections, I think he'll be bold enough to say, hardly make any, maybe a few clarification things and stuff like that, things that they can all then celebrate that they've done a great job. But they're not going to touch this stuff. And, you're hitting the ankle bracelet stuff just a minute ago. That's one of the crazy parts of this new law, right, where the bad guys have 48 hours to be AWOL on their bracelets before they can be chased. And that's the kind of stuff that's passing in the state. And I think we're just getting a preview of Illinois becoming like Cook County, where those kind of things already happen.
Well, and we also are operating on, as many sheriffs and prosecutors tried to warn us during the election cycle, we're also operating under this fantasy that there is the personnel to chase down all these individuals that are going to be that are going to walk on their own recognizance any more than they chase down people on electronic monitoring who are violating the terms of their electronic monitoring. There just isn't the personnel. And with respect to the power structure in Cook County and the state, there isn't the willpower either.
No, there's not. And all you need to do is look at the arrest rates in Chicago and, look at the sentencing. Look at all these things that have been just a dramatic failure in Chicago. And you've got – CWV does a great job of chronicling. You've got all these bad guys out there. They're multiple-time felons, and they're out on the street. And look what's happening. And you know, that's why I think there's hope in the lawsuits from all the 58 different state's attorneys in Illinois that have been combined into one lawsuit.
Yeah, but here's the deal with that, though. I mean, again, listen to what the people who authored the legislation are saying. Listen to what the Speaker of the Illinois House is saying. Listen to what Don Harmon isn't saying. Sure. Cam Buckner is running for mayor. He's touting the Safety Act as an achievement. The Black Caucus in the General Assembly, under the stewardship of Chris Welch in the House, they have demonstrated no appetite to make any changes. So it's ruled unconstitutional. And let's say the Supreme Court upholds that. Well, then they go back in January and they clean up some of the language, because a lot of the arguments are process arguments, or effectively like the one subject rule. And they limit, or they pass a series of bills that comport with the one subject rule. And we get the same thing. I mean, as you say, they're nothing if not emboldened by November 8th election results.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. The question is, can we get them to, can we create, and this is the collective we, whatever's left of us, we, who point out all the flaws, and my colleague Matt Rosenberg's done a great job of a piece we put out this morning about what should be changed but won't be changed. And there's so much bad about it. That's why we say forget tweaking it, forget trying to fix it. It should just be scrapped and started over. But you know, those are all wishful thinking comments. Yeah, you're right. I think the question is, can we just make this thing, and you know, you tried really hard with that. Now, you know, it didn't stick, I guess, in some ways, because there are other issues that came up, but it's becoming pretty obvious how bad it is. And again, I don't know why.
Enough.
The election's over. Right. The election's over. He won.
Yeah. And we can't extrapolate this Chicago and Cook County into the rest of the state. People can't see it. And, you know, sadly, it's going to take real sadness and murders and deaths and all that to kind of make it come to life.
But I mean, I was there. Cam Buckner, he was going to come on the show. I've got his cell phone number. He's ready to come on. I'm like, defend this, please. And he said, there will be nothing amended from this. This is the way it's going to be. And I don't care what Pritzker says, you know, because it was during his election, that nothing's going to be changed.
Yeah, you know, they can still do a couple small things to clarify, and like they will act like those are wins, and that's it. That's all they'll do. They don't need to do more. Sadly.
So with them back in session this week, you've got leadership votes for the Republican caucuses. There's two candidates, as I understand, on the House side to replace Jim Durkin. And Dan McConkie is going to be gone as the super minority leader in the Senate. He's going to be replaced by John Curran, state senator from DuPage County. We'll see if he can hold his seat next go around. 8 of the 60 state reps who have some part of suburban Cook and the Collars, only 8 out of 60 are Republicans, 15%.
Oh my God.
As I mentioned yesterday, the lowest number of members in any caucus since World War II, 39 in the House, 33%. Of the 8 times since World War II, I'll just keep going, from the 8 times since World War II that a caucus has had fewer than 40% of the seats in their chamber, 5 of those have been under Jim Durkin over the last decade. 5 of the 8 times since World War II. And what I see from the Republican Party, seat warmers like Steve Reich in McHenry County, who only won with 54% of the vote, he's one of the 8 that are left, and a lot of those 8 are vulnerable in 2024, depending on what the Republican Party does both nationally and locally. Steve Reich is one of those who is, you know, carrying on about what the Republican Party needs to do and so on and so forth, when he's been a seat warmer in what used to be a safe seat, increasingly not. And he voted, as so many have, to advance the Democrat socialist agenda on many occasions, like, for example, when he voted for the gas tax increase. Why did the gas tax increase and the income tax increase, why didn't those play for Republicans in this cycle? Maybe because Jim Durkin and structured a vote where Republicans passed the gas tax increase despite Democrat supermajorities, because they want Republicans on the bill, too, to make it bipartisan. Maybe because it was Bruce Rauner who promised to lower the state income tax to 3%, and instead, at the end of his term, it was 4.95%. He increased it again with Republicans coming over in service of Democrats to make it look bipartisan. Maybe those are the issues where we've muddied the waters such that the Republican Party has no definition. And now we're listening to, or we'll see if the Republican Party is listening to those handful of legislators, literally now, who are left, who were responsible for the muddying of waters, who cheerleaded the muddying of waters.
Yeah, the more they muddied the waters, the more they lost votes and positions, and then the more they muddied again. You know, they don't understand that the strategy they've been taking has actually made it worse every single time. And if you know, guys like Reich are saying the same things, well, they'll just perpetuate it and get even worse. And you know, what's fascinating about all this too is that, you know, everybody, I laugh, but all those people who thought Illinois would be better after Mike Madigan was gone, you know, this machine is alive and well and even stronger. You know, these guys, the Democrats are really smart and good, and the Republicans have no idea of how to counter it. And what's going to be, and I speak from the reform side, what's going to be sad is if they just put more Republicans in charge. You know, and you know, both McConkie and Durkin didn't keep Republicans off of Amendment 1. You know, McConkie allowed 11 of his 18 senators to vote for Amendment 1, 60% of them. So, you know, how can they expect to be differentiated? You know, if they're going to vote like Democrats, well, the people always take a real Democrat to a fake one. So the strategy doesn't work. And I remember Bill Brady telling me that he had to support the gas tax, and when he was a leader, those are destructive policies. And so they, you know, they can only blame themselves. And until they think in a reform orientation, be strong and stand up and you know, use the bully pulpit to show how kitchen table issues haven't gone away, how crime isn't going away, how corruption is still the same. I mean, they have so many strong arguments to make and so many positions to support, but instead they just kind of fold and go with the other side.
Or they say nothing.
Yeah.
You know,
they say nothing.
The same people who, like so many, decried Darren Bailey as the nominee for governor. Well, you said nothing during COVID. You're still saying nothing. You're still saying nothing as we're setting an international record for consecutive executive orders, emergency executive orders. You said nothing despite what we know, what we knew then and what we have the evidence to support now would happen if you locked down the schools. And there were other examples, counterexamples to follow if you wanted to at least make the argument of where we should go. But you said nothing. Then you show up and you think we've got $50 million to ram through somebody that we want as the entire power structure, such as it is, not much power, as the nominee. And that nominee gets pantsed in the Republican primary. And then they complain about, oh, you can't win general elections. Well, you can't win primaries because you don't have a party, because you don't have a party that has faith in your leadership. And so it's just fascinating to listen to people who all they've done is curse the darkness. Madigan this, Pritzker that, conservatives this. Curse the darkness as the means to avoid any responsibility for what happens on their watch. And if you think that trying to offload accountability to people who don't have leadership positions in the official party structure, if you think that's going to be compelling, if you think that's a party building exercise, well, then the last decade has proven just how wrong you are.
Yeah, and there's a couple things, Dan. Like you said, they haven't stood up at all or strongly enough or as a caucus and really stood together and oppose all the bad things that happen. But they also haven't been very good at being for stuff. You know, they don't give a path, a vision of what an Illinois should be, what it can be, what it used to be. And there's a lot of good messaging out there, at least to start winning people over. But instead what's happening is that they're, you know, I wouldn't say they're necessarily repelling people, but they're certainly not. They're losing people, and they're losing people that shouldn't be lost. And you just said out of all the suburbs, how people have fled,
we're relentlessly messaging every day. Why didn't everyone know about the Safety Act as soon as it was passed? Why weren't press releases coming out from every Republican legislative office time day after day leading into the 2022 election? Why aren't they telling success stories of Opportunity Scholarship kids with the tax credit scholarship program? I mean, they just show up, 90 days before primary and 90 days before general election, and hope somebody, you know, delivers them from on high. That's what they do.
Well, Well, Dan, you know, so I think here's how they need to start thinking about the next 4 years. All these kitchen table issues haven't gone away. They're going to come back in a big way. So, you know, with the Safety Act in place, crime is going to pick up. With Amendment 1, these labor unions are going to be so emboldened, they're going to demand everything in the sky.
Yeah.
So taxes are going to go up. Parents are going to see their rights totally destroyed in the teachers' contracts with all the sex ed and transgender and all that. So this is an amazing time. Amazing, I use that word. This is a time for them to figure out what that new messaging is, because the Democrats, with all their supermajorities, with all their, you know, they're going to celebrate like crazy and go crazy and make this place even worse. And so that's the opportunity. Can they figure it out or not? The Republicans, we'll see.
Ted Dabrowski, president of wirepoints.org, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks as always.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to the podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Trump is expected to announce at Mar-a-Lago that he's running for president tonight, but maybe not, because
what?
January 6th committee member,
yeah,
professional hysteric and conspiracy theorist Jamie Raskin from Maryland, he suggests that there may be something else afoot. He did over the weekend on Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan playing the dutiful, useful idiot that the D.C. press corps is so apt to play.
Election deniers didn't prevail in the key battlegrounds, but CBS tallied it, and at least 155 House Republicans in the new Congress have raised unfounded doubts about the validity or integrity of the 2020 election. These are going to be your colleagues that you will be working with. What change is that going to affect in the work you do?
Well, that's a statement about the political contamination of the GOP by Donald Trump. And again, you know, Kevin McCarthy and other leaders within the Republican Party are now required to make a decision about whether they're going to try to rid themselves of Donald Trump and his toxic influence on the party.
But these 155 House Republicans are his constituency. Kevin McCarthy, if he wants to be leader, will need to consider.
Yes. Well, it's a real problem for Kevin McCarthy now, because there are certain pro-Trumpists within his House caucus who refuse to accept that he's really with Trump, and they want to get rid of McCarthy. And some of them, they have names very early in the alphabet, like Biggs, and they might just vote for Trump when they, you know, take the roll call for Speaker. So we know that the hard right Freedom Caucus people are in search of another candidate. And one potential candidate whose name has been floated is Donald Trump himself, because...
Donald, I mean, seriously. Trump's going to be Speaker of the House?
Yeah, Donald Trump's going to announce tonight from Mar-a-Lago that he's running for Speaker. That's according to Jamie Raskin, who's an election inventor.
Give me a break.
These guys.
This is right.
And
comical.
And then also, too, Margaret Brennan, the 155 election deniers. These are your colleagues. How can you work with these Martians? An election denier is anyone, according to them, who raises any questions about what they see in terms of election counting in places like Maricopa County. Just like an insurrectionist is anyone who voted for Donald Trump, even if they've never even been to Washington, D.C., much less were there on January 6th. And the question is, how can Jamie Raskin work with them? Of course, the converse is never asked by the Margaret Brennans of the world. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Dave Seminara, former diplomat, author of Footsteps of Federer and Mad Travelers, A Tale of Wanderlust, Greed, and the Quest to Reach the Ends of the Earth. Dave, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for having me back on your show.
What do you expect tonight, Trump to announce he's running for Speaker of the House or President?
Oh, boy. Not Speaker of the House, unfortunately. I don't know. Not that I wanted to be Speaker of the House either, but, you know, I'm in a bad mental space after the election. I'm still angry about what took place. Mm-hmm. We had an opportunity. If we could not win, not just win, too, I'm not talking about a 3-seat majority in the House or any nonsense like this. If we could not absolutely clean the Democrats' clock at a time like this, when are you ever going to win? And we hog, you know, I'm in Florida here. We hog the entire red wave all for ourselves here. We did our part here in Florida. But what happened around the rest of the country? Incredible. I mean, the polls actually got it wrong in our favor for once. I mean, I was looking back at the polls again this morning. I mean, the Real Clear Politics average of polls in a lot of these races, like, you know, Carrie Lake in Arizona, my God, her Real Clear Politics average was like a 4-point. She was going to win by 4 points. That of Oz, all the polls were showing Oz was going to win, and he lost. I mean, this is a time right now where there's got to be some soul searching that happens. I mean, I wrote a column the other day about the reaction from different Republicans and Democrats. I mean, Rona McDaniel, chairwoman of the GOP, likened the election to the GOP winning the Super Bowl. Seriously?
Yeah. That's bad.
Winning the Super Bowl? There's so much everyone is delusional.
We need to master the mail-in ballots. That's what Republicans need to master in order to win again, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's part of it. But, I mean, look, I voted by mail here in Florida. A lot of Republicans here in Florida voted by mail. And unlike what Anna Navarro and all of these other liars on CNN and MSNBC said, no, it is not hard to vote by mail here in Florida. I mean, Anna Navarro was on CNN, you know, trying to explain away DeSantis' 20-point win claiming that he made it really hard for people to vote by mail. No, it's not hard at all. But we don't just mass mail ballots to every person in the state as they do in Nevada and other states, which – yeah, I mean, that's an issue, but I don't think we can just focus on that. I mean, clearly there's other stuff at work here.
Part of it is
fallout, Trump, yeah, I mean, others.
Part of it, though, you know, on the flip side, I know Trump is catching a lot of heat. Some of it, I think, is deserved, but it's not the entire story. Some of this, you know, is maybe difficult, but this is what we have to reconcile, is, as Rick Scott said, our people didn't come out. And we see that in a number of states, not everywhere, but in a number of states. And, you know, that's, you know, what I saw in Illinois. That's a lot of people who voted for Trump in 16 and 20 and didn't come out in 18 and didn't come out again in 2022.
Listen, it's amazing. Here in Florida, we had 61% turnout for registered Republican and 48% turnout for registered Democrats. Why is that? Because we love our governor. We're excited about him. We're excited about actually going to the polls and casting a ballot for him. I mean, I've talked to people. I've got relatives and friends in so many other states. People were not excited about the Republican candidates. In fact, some Republicans I know downright dislike them. So candidate quality obviously is a huge issue. As we talked about, you know, Trump, I mean, the baggage of Trump and also abortion. I mean, look, here in Florida, I mean, I'm pro-life. Don't get me wrong. But here in Florida, our law is 15 weeks, right? Abortion is allowed until 15 weeks, which obviously pro-choice people, they don't like it. But it's not so, you know, so strict that it's driving people to the polls and they're, you know, they're furious about it. It's a compromise. You know what I mean? And I feel like if we want to be completely uncompromising on issues like abortion, and believe me, again, I'm pro-life, but we're going to have a fallout to that.
Yeah, but I think that's a lot more complicated because I don't think that's the case. I don't think there – I mean, there are examples, but for every example you give me of somebody who's uncompromising, I can give you a counter. But Lee Zeldin is pro-life in New York State, and he had the best performance of a Republican in New York State biggest GOP vote across the state in almost five decades, best performance since Pataki won, you know, 25 years ago. You know, Mike DeWine is pro-life, and he signed a heartbeat bill, too, and he won by 25 points, as you mentioned, DeSantis and so on and so forth. So I think it's more complicated than just invoking abortion. And I know you're not suggesting this, but a lot of people just invoke abortion. You can't talk about it. Don't talk about it. Don't say anything about it. And then you just cede all the ground in terms of defining that issue and who's the extremist to the left.
No, I'm just saying it's part of the picture. It's part of the puzzle. To me, Trump baggage is a big part of it. Candidate quality is a big part of it. Abortion is a big part of it. And when I say abortion, I don't even necessarily mean in a specific state, but I think the states that passed very strict abortion laws after Dobbs, even not just didn't have just ramification in that state, but it sent a message around the country, right? And it allowed Democrats to portray us as extreme. And clearly it drove a lot of young people to the polls, as well as this bogus,
Except nationally, that's not true. Nationally, the vote under 30 represented 12% of the overall vote, which is right in the sweet spot of where it normally is in midterms, 11 to 13% the last four. I mean,
what was the issue driving them to the polls?
It doesn't matter. You're saying there was like a massive turnout of under 30s that propelled Democrats. Well, that's not true as a proportion of the overall turnout. It's just more complicated than what people want to believe.
No, I agree with you, Dan. You make good points. But here's what I thought was interesting. Before the election, when they were asking people, what's your top issue? You know, is inflation by a mile and abortion was single digits. Then I saw, you know, exit polls afterwards, a couple of them. One of them said 27% of the voters said abortion was their key issue. Mm-hmm. And then another poll, it was something like that too, 25%. So something happened there. There was a big disconnect between the polls before the election and then the actual exit polls. So I hear what you're saying. You're right. It wasn't all just, can't just blame it on young people. But clearly, there was a variety of different things that happened here. And moving forward, the key thing is, where do we move forward here? Heads have got to roll.
Well,
I mean, you know, I'm here in Florida. I'm not a part of the DeSantis campaign. But right now, there's going to be a civil war in the Republican Party. It's going to be a battle here. And I don't see a path for Trump to win in 2024. Leaving aside, debating all of his flaws and everything, I don't see the math. That's my issue. Is how do you get he's going to be a 78-year-old candidate. With unfavorables, every poll in the world you look at is unfavorables. Somewhere in the best poll is unfavorables, let's say 52 or 53. And in the worst is unfavorables, like 58 or 60. What is the math for Trump to win in 2024? I don't see it.
Well, is there anything
I see
he could
math for him to get the nomination? I don't see the math for him to win.
But besides the math, is there anything he could say tonight during his primetime speech, which will be 8:00 Central Time, that would convince you otherwise?
Nothing in the world, because the problem is he doesn't have to convince me. I'm a Republican, right? I vote Republican. He's got to convince independents. And unfortunately, people have already made up their mind about Trump. This is the problem with him. No one in America is still undecided on Trump. No one.
Yeah, I mean, those are legitimate questions to raise and problems that he has to address and be persuasive. There's no question about that, particularly with somebody poised to challenge him where there is great enthusiasm, and that's, of course, DeSantis. I wanted something else, though. You mentioned candidate quality, and I'm hearing this a lot, too, and that, to me, is another complicated variable because Katie Hobbs and John Fetterman were such great candidates.
No, I don't think so.
And you embedded it with Fetterman. I read your piece in The Spectator about being a phone banker for Fetterman. Tell us that experience.
And people weren't excited about Fetterman either. Believe me, I made calls on behalf of both Republicans and Democrats just to do a little Oppo research and such, right? And, yeah, I made calls to voters in Pennsylvania asking about Fetterman. And it was very interesting. There wasn't enthusiasm for Fetterman. I mean, it wasn't like people were excited about Fetterman as a candidate either. But I think Oz was perceived as a carpetbagger. Republicans didn't turn out for him. And the big thing that I think people are not talking about is you got to look at the voter registration in Pennsylvania. The Democrats are starting with, I just looked this up, a 550,000 registration edge. There's 550,000 more Democrats than Republicans in the state. So Pennsylvania is an uphill climb. Right.
At least Fetterman debated his candidate, where Katie Hobbs stayed in the basement literally and refused to debate Carrie Lake. And it turns out, guess what? She lost by 20,000 votes. And that's exactly what President Trump lost by.
She gets to run. Well, she got to run the election, though. I mean, as Secretary of State, that's a nice advantage, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, but the point you make about Pennsylvania, too, you know, we start the press corps wants us to believe that these races start like, you know, everybody starts at the same place in the race. And here's Pennsylvania is a blue state. It certainly leans blue normally these days. And what we saw, I would argue, is that it was a rally around the flag, which is why only one statewide incumbent in the entire country lost. And that was Sisolak, the governor of Nevada. One incumbent lost in these volatile times. Yeah. Rally around the flag. Red got redder and blue got bluer. I mean, between DeSantis, DeWine, and Abbott, and if you throw in like Bill Lee in Tennessee, I mean, those four statewide totals represent about 80% of the Republican vote majority in the country. So, you know, red getting redder, blue getting bluer, that's part of the discussion too.
Yeah. Here's what I want Republicans to focus like a laser on moving forward. Women. I mean, how much longer are we going to lose by 8 or 10 points in the female vote? We can't keep going like this. Here in Florida, I think what DeSantis did really wisely to capture a lot of mom votes is really focus on education. I mean, he expanded school choice. School choice is popular. Republicans do not talk about it enough or advocate for it enough. He kept the schools open. Mothers were very grateful about that. Many Republicans around the country forgot about the pandemic, forgot about even raising it as an issue, how our schools were closed down. I mean, we got to at least perform like close to 50-50 with the female vote. If we could get close to 50-50, we will dominate. As long as we keep losing 8 or 10 points among the female vote, which they vote more than men do. I looked at most of the recent exit polls. Women were like 52% of the electorate. We can't keep losing by 8 or 10% with that.
Yeah, but it's
candidates like Trump. Women don't like Donald Trump. His ratings amongst women are horrible.
Also more complicated because it's not women; it's unmarried women. That's really what it is.
Yeah,
unmarried women.
Well, there's a lot of those in America.
I know, but I mean, in terms of if you want to make an appeal, then you have to look at where the real disconnect is, and it's unmarried women. And you know, again, that's a complicated conversation. All right, Dave Seminara, former diplomat, author
Thank
of Footsteps.
I'm sorry if I was very gloomy.
No, it's all good. Dave, he's also the author of Footsteps of Federer and Mad Travelers, A Tale of Wanderlust, Greed, and the Quest to Reach the Ends of the Earth. Dave Seminara, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. There's nothing more entertaining than an international climate conference. COP27, this U.S.-sponsored confab in Sharm el-Sheikh, is occurring. You know how you know? Because 400 private jets arrived in Egypt for the conference. To decry people's carbon footprints.
The elitist snobs. Give me a break.
It's so entertaining. And, of course, Biden is there to offer bon mots to Xi. And she's there to pretend like he gives a rat's ass about global temperature. and of course, the climate cultists are out in force. Listen to this crew that went to the top of Mount Sinai to symbolically break stone tablets,
what?
A la Moses, coming down from on high.
The climate promises have not been kept worldwide, including in Israel.
Whoa.
Wow.
And when it comes to the leaders of the world who are gathering at COP27, there's a lot of talk. There's some action, but there's not enough to be able to keep the world to 1.5 degrees on the warming. The whole world needs to cut our emissions by half by 2030, and they're not yet. We take these green commandments, we look down to Sharm el-Sheikh, and we're not satisfied.
Oh.
Hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
All hail Mother Gaia. But it's not a cult.
Oh, not at all.
No, it's not a cult. And part of the Sharm el-Sheikh down, as people are calling it, appropriately, reparations, first world reparations to countries like Venezuela. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Maduro, sure, everybody get in line. Maduro's in on this. He destroys his country. He drives, 5 million people out of Venezuela?
And they're all coming here. Yeah.
And he wants reparations for the first world's impact on global climate. I mean, they got a racket going, boy, don't they? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Emmett Penny, editor of Grid Brief, a newsletter on fossil fuels, renewables, nuclear, and the grid, contributing editor at Compact Magazine, and host of the Nuclear Barbarians podcast. Well, that's a good name for a podcast. Emmett Penny, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Can those individuals at the top of Mount Sinai, can they get an amen from you?
not at all. I don't go in for golden calves.
Yeah, right.
Well, I hope they cleaned up after themselves. They left a lot of garbage behind.
Yeah, it's the broken green tablets.
Well, they didn't take the garbage with them.
So what can we expect coming out of this momentous conference, COP27, with all of these heads of state?
A lot of press releases, mostly.
Yeah.
And that's about it. I mean, you know, I have a friend, I have a few friends that are there right now, and one of them is a nuclear advocate that used to work with me when we both worked for Mr. Michael Schellenberger. Oh. And one thing she pointed out is that even the countries that have a huge, robust nuclear program aren't featuring nuclear in any of their displays of how they're going to solve climate change. Actually, the only country that's doing that seems to be the United Arab Emirates.
Right, and that's because, I mean, I think I know why, but develop that for us. Why wouldn't they want to profile the solution to their energy needs?
Well, because it basically makes the entire activist class, the NGO class, and the parasitic renewables developers irrelevant. Renewables can't compete with nuclear on a technical basis at all. But it's been demonized for so long by the green left that they are now painting themselves into a corner by fragilizing their own societies with renewables, as we see in places like Germany, and shutting down nuclear plants. And so that's why they're not putting it forward. I would also add that it's probably also because they tend to be, well, NGO people and bureaucrats, so they're cowards.
Well, how much renewable energy do we use here in the United States? I mean, if you ever drive to Palm Springs, you see that whole, you know, wind farm. We have them on I-55 and at certain places. Are they effective at all?
I mean, to some degree, technically, there is, I don't think, any place in the country where wind operates more than 45% of the time. And the average capacity performance for solar nationwide is 24% of the time. So that's what you get.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like it's going to be enough to power the world's largest economy. Just, you know, back of the envelope here.
No, not at all, especially because you don't get to pick which 24% or 45% of the time that is. I say that it's like running a Rube Goldberg machine on rigged coin tosses.
Well, Antonio Guterres, who is the Secretary General, he's a former Socialist Party Prime Minister of Portugal, and obviously we want to tie our lot to socialists from Portugal. That makes sense. We're on a highway to climate hell, invoking AC/DC, and it's either a climate solidarity pact or a collective suicide pact. That's the sort of measured, thoughtful rhetoric we're getting from these deep thinkers in Egypt.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that's completely irresponsible, not just because it's wrong. There is no scenario that has human extinction in it. In the IPCC, which is the major committee that does the science on climate and stuff like that. But it's also demoralizing for the public to hear that your society isn't going to exist. I think that there's this idea that fear is going to bring people together when, in fact, it does the opposite. It turns them into survivalists who don't value their own civilization.
Well, fear and shaming. I mean, it's worked so well on so many other policy fronts in terms of silencing dissent. They figure, why wouldn't it work with climate politics as well?
Yeah, and they've been doing it for a long, long time with climate. I actually think that a lot of the stuff that we saw happened during and after COVID, you know, there was institutional path dependency for that type of shaming and fear-mongering built up over the last 20, 30 years of the climate movement.
And now, how excited should we be about this climate gender equity fund that Biden has launched recently to advance women-led climate solutions? It's not, you know, and you got, what, $120 billion for John Podesta to pass out to the connected, to his friends. So, you know, the $120 billion from the what they called infrastructure, sort of backdoor Green New Deal. So we're going to also focus on making sure that women are leading the climate solutions here. Is that important?
I mean, I guess it depends on how excited you are to see an art installation from Marina Abramovich. I mean, I don't really know what any of that means. I mean, I don't think that they could tell you either. You know, I mean, this is it's just retail politics. That's all that's happening there. You know, like the climate scenarios or the climate solutions that are all renewables based, that's just conference BS. And then the sort of women-led, whatever they're saying about that, that's all just them helping their friends, like you said. I mean, there's nothing to really expect from here. There's no real seriousness with which we're dealing with this issue on any level. And that's a real shame, I think. It's a missed opportunity for America to be a real leader in how we decide energy policy globally.
You know, you mentioned Michael Schellenberger, and he's done such interesting work over many years now as an environmental activist. And then more recently, after a couple years ago, when he issued that mea culpa about his participation in environmental hysteria, and really just continues to drill down on the actual science and the data and what we understand, not just about climate change, but other environmental issues, and just be, you know, intellectually curious and as thoughtful and honest as he can be with what we know to be true versus what we don't exactly know or we don't exactly understand. I wonder how he is being treated within those political and policy circles in which he used to operate after that mea culpa and his willingness to be a heretic.
Well, I've seen a little bit of it, and, you know, obviously I'm friends with Michael. I love the guy, and I really support what he's doing. And he's, you know, he's basically like an independent progressive, you know, like those are his actual politics. And so how they respond to Michael, and this goes back to your shaming thing, is I've seen people, like, without any sense of irony, call him a right-wing nationalist, which is, like, the last thing I would ever ascribe to Michael Schellenberger, of all people. Mm-hmm. It's just crazy. They don't want to entertain his arguments. Right. They don't want to think deeply about what they're doing. They want to protect what they have. That's the best way to think about what's happening with this climate stuff, is they're protecting the patronage networks that they've developed. That's really what that politics is about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good summation. Emmett Penny, editor of Grid Brief, newsletter on fossil fuels, renewables, nuclear, and the grid, contributing editor at Compact Magazine, and host of the Nuclear Barbarians podcast. Emmett Penny, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
It was a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.